So now we have our marathon case. I'm going to be pretty strict about times for everybody, and whether you reserve time, if you want to, you're going to have to be very careful about that. Generally, it doesn't work very well, reserving time. So let's start with, we're going to hear three consolidated cases. Well, for argument anyway, 24-7035, Krueger versus Phillips et al., 24-7037, Krueger versus Orr et al., 24-7066, Krueger versus Crockett et al. I should have said Krueger et al. So we'll start with 24-7035, Mr. Kim, and you have 15 minutes.
Thank you, Your Honors. May it please the Court, my name is John Kim. I represent defendants appellants Nicholas Orr, Caleb Phillips, and Matthew Lott. As Your Honors are well aware, this appeal concerns a late-night traffic stop of Mr. Jeffrey Krueger on July 1st, 2019. After Wagner County Sheriff's deputies Orr and Phillips observed Mr. Krueger's strange behavior and reckless driving, Mr. Krueger was pulled over. Mr. Krueger abruptly pulled over into the center turn lane of a busy highway at night and opened his door. The traffic stop escalated after Mr. Krueger refused to comply with a series of simple, progressive commands issued by deputies Orr and Phillips, who were in full uniform. While ignoring commands, Mr. Krueger dug around in his vehicle if he was looking for something. This was unusual because at that point, he was never asked to do anything but show his hands by the deputies. Due to the rising uncertainty and safety concerns created by Mr. Krueger's continued noncompliance, Deputy Phillips attempted to physically restrain Mr. Krueger. In response, Mr. Krueger grabbed and assaulted Deputy Phillips and even tried to grab at his gun. At that point, what should have been a routine traffic stop turned into violent ground combat. Mr. Krueger violently fought off both deputies as they tried to arrest him. He fought back against arrest so vigorously that the deputies had to call for help, and this was all plainly captured by Phillips' body camera. It wasn't until EMTs arrived on scene to help that the deputies were even able to handcuff Mr. Krueger. In addition to EMTs, additional officers of the Wagner Police Department and the Sheriff's Office responded to calls for help. Despite being handcuffed and given repeated orders to stop resisting, Mr. Krueger did everything but. Mr. Krueger's continued resistance, which included kicking the officers, necessitated the use of leg shackles. Just moments after the leg shackles were applied,
Let me ask. What's the evidence regarding how Mr. Krueger's head was bloodied? I thought that is, we don't have any video of that, do we?
I believe that's based on possibly some photographs of the scene.
But we don't know how that happened. And the district court said, maybe incorrectly, but this is the sort of thing we have to defer to the district court on. The court said a jury might find, could find, that the officers bashed his head against the pavement, which might have been necessary, but might well have been excessive force. So that's the factual, you've recited a lot of relevant factual information, but there's that gap. And I thought the district court was relying on that gap in denying summary judgment.
Your Honor, even if there was a gap, I believe that based on the totality of the circumstances, that presumably happened during the course of the attempted arrest. And the case law in our circuit is very clearly established that the Fourth Amendment jurisprudence allows the right to use some force in order to effectuate an arrest.
Well, some force isn't any force, and some force isn't deadly force, right? It has to be proportional.
Correct, Judge McEwen.
And so can we agree that a prone restraint is deadly force?
Judge McHugh, I think based on the law that's clearly established, there's a little bit more to it than just being prone and restrained. I believe the cases such as the state of Booker, Weigel, Cruz, those established that it's not just being prone and restrained, but it's the application of substantial and significant weight on the prone.
Well, restraint. In this case, given the autopsy results, a reasonable jury could find there was substantial weight placed, right? Don't we have broken ribs?
Your Honor, I believe the autopsy report doesn't explain when or at what point those ribs were broken and how they were broken.
I thought there was some evidence that some of them were broken when they threw him down to the ground, busted his head open, and some were broken during the while he was prone and they were sitting on him.
Your Honor, I think the evidence only shows that at some point during the beginning and the end, where Mr. Krueger's transported away, is somewhere at that point that occurred, but it's not necessarily pinpointed as to at what point that happened, whether it was at the very beginning of the arrest or at the very end or sometime somewhere in the middle, and it's unclear.
Well, is that a jury question then?
Your Honor, if there's no evidence for a jury to consider, I'm not really sure how they can get to a conclusion.
Well, there is evidence. You've got autopsy report, you've got some gruesome photographs, you've got a clump of bloody hair, and you have a person who died after being subjected to a prolonged prone restraint.
Judge McHugh, if you'll let me, I'd like to kind of split that up, at least as to the initial phase of the arrest involving Deputies Orr and Phillips. They only used the force that was proportionately necessary to restrain him. At that point, when he was handcuffed, they immediately got off of him.
Was it necessary to restrain him or to pull him out of the car to throw his head against the ground and have a large gash, large open bleeding gash? Was that necessary?
Judge Moritz, it was necessary because when Phillips decided to restrain Mr. Krueger, he reached and grabbed him and even tried to attempt to grab his service weapon.
Isn't that controverted?
I don't think that's...
I mean, I understand that we don't have the victim's not alive to tell us, but haven't they controverted that by the fact that these two defendants, Phillips and Orr, have some credibility issues, particularly with respect to the fact that they essentially lied about, you know, the fact that they said they left after, you know, after they got off of the suspect, they left, they said, and didn't hear anything else until they heard he wasn't breathing, when in fact Potts' video shows that they absolutely didn't leave, they were there. That's one credibility issue. Isn't there a credibility issue as to whether they were telling the truth about what was happening in the vehicle and their basis for pulling them out of the car?
Judge Moritz, I believe all the circumstantial evidence pointed by the plaintiffs' appellees regarding the credibility issues don't necessarily raise any questions about the veracity of what Phillips and Orr have testified to.
How else would you raise a credibility issue when the victim is deceased? He can't speak for himself. By showing that they lied about what happened after that and said they weren't there when in fact they were and didn't intervene.
Judge Moritz,
how else would you show credibility?
Well, I believe you could point to some inconsistent testimony.
That's inconsistent, isn't it? Their testimony was inconsistent with what the video showed. Isn't that a credibility issue? Pretty strong one.
Well, Judge Moritz, I think it depends on how far you take, whether literally you take their statement that they left. They were still generally on the scene, but they weren't anywhere near Mr. Krueger.
They could see what was going on.
Your Honor, I believe
they were in the video right there.
Yeah, we can see them.
We can see them.
Behind the circle of other officers while they were all at ground.
It's a fact question at a minimum, isn't it? Whether that was true, that they just were gone and didn't know what was going on. Isn't that at least a fact question based on what the video shows?
Your Honor, I think I would respectfully disagree. I don't think it's materially disputed that they walked away. I think even the body camera footage early on captures Orr and Phillips having walked away, set their vest down because they were so exhausted from the strenuous struggle. They were by a police vehicle about 20, 30 feet from where Mr. Krueger was prone and restrained.
Well, there's a number of items that the plaintiffs rely on to show a credibility issue with respect to those two officers. And if there is a credibility issue, then can we assume as a fact that their version of the facts when they pulled him out, that he reached for the gun or that he was fighting them? We don't have any video because that's another point. Phillips body cam doesn't start with the usual 20 to 30 seconds for some reason.
That's correct, Judge Moritz. But even what...
The two of them didn't file a police report for some reason. Those are things that they point to as far as the lack of credibility.
Well, as far as what was captured on body camera footage, I think it can't be disputed that when the footage does begin, Mr. Kruger's violently and aggressively fighting off two fully uniformed deputies.
Well, he's also being repeatedly tased. How many people can stay still when they're... And he's being tased at a higher voltage than is the norm, right? And, there's a dispute about how many times he's tased, but when you watch the video, it sure looks like they're tasing him quite a lot.
Judge McHugh, the video does capture the audio of the taser arcing, but I believe the evidence in the summary judgment record by plaintiff's own expert shows that there's no data that conclusively shows that those taser arcs actually made contact with Mr. Kruger. There's a difference between just the arcing and then making contact. There's no way to
stab. It's a fact question.
If the plaintiff's own expert can't testify as to whether taser ever made contact, I'm not really sure what a jury could consider.
Well, the experts, I thought, said seven times. Mm-hmm. He was tased seven times during that short period of time.
If I recall, that was probably an extrapolation from what was based on the computer data of the taser. But again, I think conclusively that expert ultimately couldn't testify one way or another with any positivity whether the contact was actually made during
those two. Well, I saw contact being made. Can the jury do that too?
Sure, Judge McHugh, but then I think I would still go back to the point that on body camera footage, it's plainly obvious that this Mr. Kruger was given simple commands to give up his hands and he wasn't being able...
Well, at one point he's being given a command to turn over and you can see in the video somebody's holding his head down and you can hear him saying, what am I supposed to do?
How can I turn over?
And in your, I think it's your brief, somebody's brief argues that you can't hear him calling for help and saying things. I can hear him. I don't know why you can't hear him.
Judge McHugh, I can't speak to why Mr. Kruger said that, but it doesn't seem like the command of giving up your hands is one that couldn't be complied with easily. I think it's undisputed in the video that he had them tucked underneath him.
I was confused about something a few minutes ago, but with respect to Officers Orr and Phillips, is there any allegation that they put pressure on Mr. Kruger while he was lying down, face down, that they put pressure on his back or shoulders?
I don't think it's directly addressed on point because at that time they were still struggling to restrain him. Naturally, while they're engaged in ground combat, while Mr. Kruger's fighting back, they presumably had some undetermined amount of weight on him, but that was still during the restraint period. And I think even the circuit's laws clearly established that it's really only when a suspect is actually subdued and restrained. I think in some of the other similar factual cases, it wasn't until the suspect's legs were restrained and hands were restrained, and then when weight is placed on that suspect, that you run into some violative conduct under the Fourth Amendment.
And he was never restrained when Orr and Phillips were involved. Is that right?
Correct, Judge Hartz. I think even the district court even determined that when Lawton and the other additional officers arrived on scene in response to the calls for help, Mr. Kruger was still kicking his legs at that point.
But back to my original inquiry about the gash to his head, that's a different claim against Orr and Phillips, is it not? And there, didn't the judge rely on the fact that we don't have any video of how that happened? And the judge said, essentially, a reasonable fact finder could find that the officers used excessive force in causing that wound.
Your Honor, I would state that the law in our circuit says that even a considerable amount of force, even such as the one used here, may be necessary to effectuate an arrest.
Yes.
I think otherwise, there's this invisible demarcation in time at which an officer has to let a suspect go because they might fear that they have used too much force before an arrest is even effectuated.
Well, if he's struggling, they couldn't put a gun to his head and
shoot him,
blow his brains out, right? That would be excessive. It's not like anything goes. And that's what the judge is saying. We don't know what happened here. And if they had him down and they start bashing his head against the pavement, which they, of course, deny, that if the if the jury found that, they could find that the officers violated clearly established law in doing that.
Judge Hartz, conversely, I think a jury would also look at the body camera footage and realize that even after that occurred, Mr. Krueger wasn't restrained. The arrest hasn't been effected yet.
But so you're saying you can dash their head against the asphalt repeatedly if they're still fighting?
Judge McHugh, I believe...
I'm not sure what your point is.
My point is that an officer can use proportional... can increase their use of force proportionally in response to a suspect's resistance to arrest.
Well, it's really about whether the officer is in danger, right? You can use the proportional force that is necessary at the moment, and as Judge Hartz pointed out, you can't shoot him. You know, we have case law from the Supreme Court, even when someone's ignoring all your commands and running away, you can't shoot him in the back, right?
Correct, Judge McHugh.
So he's certainly resisting arrest, but you can't shoot him.
Okay, yes, time's up.
Sorry.
Your 15 minutes has expired.
Oh.
That's 23 seconds.
Oh, I'm sorry. Thank you, Your Honor.
Mr. LeBlanc, is that right?
Yes, sir.
And you're in 7037. So
yes, sir.
So you're, why don't you name the, it's the officers with the sheriffs? No.
No, sir. I'm Thomas LeBlanc on behalf of these Wagner City police officers, Tyler McFarland, Andrew Craig, Benjamin Blair, and Corey Nevitt. And yes, Your Honor, this is appeal number 247037.
Thank you.
Your Honors, may it please the court. In its decision below, the trial court erred in denying these four officers qualified immunity. The facts in the case law identified by the trial court do not support a Fourth Amendment violation for excessive force, nor a Fourth Amendment violation for failure to intervene. The facts in case law identified by the trial court do not support a finding that the law was clearly established such that every reasonable officer on that scene under these specific facts would know beyond debate that the actions of McFarland and Craig constituted excessive force.
Well, we have pretty clear, clearly established law that if someone is restrained, then you cannot do certain things on the person's back, maybe shoulders, while they're lying there prone. Do you agree with that clearly established law, or do you want to...
I would like to discuss that a little bit, Your Honor.
Okay.
I think, and the court and the appellees very clearly relied heavily, almost exclusively, on this court's opinion in the Weigel case. And as we point out in our papers, Your Honor, the Weigel decision was a fractured decision and under an analysis of a very specific set of facts. And the takeaway from the Weigel case ultimately was that it is inappropriate to continue to apply force to the upper torso of a fully restrained individual. And as Your Honor knows, the concurrence in that case made an effort to actually clearly demarcate a difference between applying force to a continuing, struggling, and resisting individual versus that point at which that person is clearly under control. And in the Weigel case...
But in Weigel, the majority first says that every reasonable officer would have known that the pressure placed on Mr. Weigel's upper back as he lay on his stomach created a significant risk of asphyxiation and death. Then it says, additionally, there was evidence that he continued to fight. I see those as two separate conclusions. And it is true. Every reasonable officer knows that a prone restraint can be lethal.
With respect, Your Honor, what every reasonable officer knows is that in some circumstances, it is potential that a prolonged prone restraint with significant weight can be potentially lethal. But, Your Honor, every day in this country, thousands of arrestees are placed in a prone position in order to be handcuffed without injury or incident. And, in fact, the literature that was even cited and proffered to the court in both the Cruz case and I believe in Weigel also clearly indicates that death from positional asphyxia is exceedingly rare. So to suggest that it is per se deadly force is not the law in the Tenth Circuit, has never been the law. And if that were the case, then every single arrest would involve the use of deadly force. Virtually, not every.
I overstate. And I think I wrote the concurrence, which was between them, Judge Seymour and Judge Baldock. And I thought it said that the issue is once they're restrained. We didn't say in that decision that it was wrong to put weight on the back before the person, while Mr. Weigel was still struggling.
Right.
But once he was bound, he could not run back onto the highway, which was the problem to start with. Then, to continue to use that force, given the risk of death, was excessive. And I thought that's how I described the law when I asked my first question and asked whether you agree with that as being the clearly established law. If that is, then the issue here is, was he restrained?
Well, he was not fully restrained, Your Honor, until the hobble chain was placed, which was at the very end, and it was literally, there's no question in the record that immediately when the hobble chain was attached, Officer McFarland released all pressure. You can see in the video as he starts to come back away, you can only see his upper portion. We don't see Mr. Krueger. But it's clear that as the hobble chain, you can hear it being applied.
But that's the issue. That's the issue.
And
then the second question is, because I see opposing counsel shaking his head, is whether the evidence supports conclusively one side or the other.
Well, the trial court clearly found that Mr. Krueger was continuing to resist, at least to some degree, throughout the entire incident. There's no finding anywhere.
The video doesn't show that, though, doesn't it? The video shows him motionless for almost 90 seconds, and McFarland was still on him, and Crockett was still on him. This is before they put the shackles on him.
And
he was motionless.
And this is
not long after that, they say he's not breathing.
And this is the problem we run into, Your Honor.
They were still on top of him. He was subdued, and they were on top of him. He was laying prone. His hands were handcuffed. Then they put the shackles on him. He was subdued.
And this is why the law with regard to use of force and qualified immunity is so important and difficult, as Your Honor mentioned earlier in some cases, because everything has to be viewed in totality of circumstance and in context and in continuum. And so what you have in this case is a continuum of this extreme violence and resistance. It continues even after he's handcuffed. We see him kick Deputy Standifer hard enough to knock him backwards.
He's subdued at some point.
You're right.
They're still sitting on him. They still got him handcuffed. They still have him prone. Why isn't it at a minimum, as the district court found, a question of fact?
Because, Your
for
Honor.
For the jury to decide.
Because, Your Honor, in Weigel, as the court recognized in the concurrence, there was at least a 3-minute period after which one of the officers was so comfortable with the situation that he was subdued that he left and went in his car to warm his hands. That's not our situation. Our situation is he is handcuffed. He's continuing to resist and struggle. So the decision is made, well, let's put ankle cuffs is the way the judge
referred
to.
When they put those on, he was subdued.
No, Your Honor, he's not, because he can still kick and fight at that point.
He can or he is.
Was he resisting?
That's
important.
Well, you're right.
The word subdued doesn't mean he might start kicking again.
And that's where this court and the trial court has to look at this from the perspective of the officers on the scene not the comfort of our offices and chambers.
We know that. But when we have a video that shows him subdued for 90 seconds, why would we not at least say, as the district court did, well, let's let the jury see that and see what they think?
Because in context, from the perspective of the officers on scene, they had made a decision and an assessment of this individual under these facts that in addition to the cuffs on the ankle, we need to hobble chain, which, by the way, is very different than a hog tie, which was the Cruz case.
And it doesn't matter because Cruz wasn't decided on the basis of hog tie or hobble tie or whatever. So I think it's a difference without distinction or a distinction without a difference.
Well,
call it a hog tie, hobble tie, whatever. The issue is whether the video is enough to create a jury question.
I think it's not, Your Honor. I think based on the video and when viewed from the perspective of the officers on the scene, their assessment was we need to hobble chain him. In addition, they were restraining him for that purpose.
Does it matter at all if the defendant, in this case the decedent, is any danger to the officers? Is that relevant at all?
It clearly is. And when the trial judge, looking at the Graham factors to assess the objective reasonableness, found all of the Graham factors, including the threat.
In the beginning, the trial court never did the assessment at the relevant time period. I mean, you know, the Graham factors are not static during a police encounter. And so it may be that in the beginning of the encounter, that's how you weigh them. But a reasonable officer has to be aware that things change. And when the guy is no longer a danger to me, I can't use force that might kill him.
I see that my time is up.
Answer the question and then...
You're right. An officer does have to exercise some judgment. And that's exactly the point I'm trying to make, Your Honor, which is in the judgment of these officers in real time, in the middle of the highway, with this particular individual, the assessment was we need to hobble chain in addition to the ankle. And as soon as that was done, all pressure was released. I think that's consistent with the court's decision in Weigel. And with all due respect, the Cruz decision did very clearly distinguish between a hog tie and a hobble chain. And the reason for that has to do with the potential pressure on the diaphragm when you hog tie someone versus allowing room for them to extend their legs with a hobble chain.
Thank you. Any other questions? Thank you, counsel.
Thank you.
You're going to have to pronounce your name for me, Mr. Jerry's.
It's Gary's.
Gary's,
right.
Yeah.
Part G.
And you're in 24-7066, and your clients are?
Lieutenant Crockett, only Lieutenant Crockett.
With what department?
The Sheriff's Department, Wagner County Sheriff's Office. May it please the court, my name is Steve Gary's. I represent Lieutenant Elizabeth Crockett. I think that it's important for the court to recognize exactly what the district court found with regard to the facts as they pertain to Lieutenant Crockett. And the court found that after observing Mr. Krueger kick an officer, that would have been Deputy Standiford, she assisted in kneeling down on Mr. Krueger's left buttock and upper left thigh and assisted in placing the leg irons on him. Lieutenant Crockett kneeled down on Mr. Krueger's left buttock and left upper thigh for approximately 45 seconds to a minute total until he had been placed in leg irons. She then left the area and went to her vehicle and had no further contact with Mr. Krueger.
I thought the district court also made a finding that she placed her weight on his back along with the other officers. Said that at some point.
The court does say that, but that's factually...
And looking at the video, it's hard to tell. Is it his lower back? Is it his upper left thigh? You know, assume that's what we can imply from that, is that the district court is saying she's in this area of his back.
Well, I think the court is meaning backside rather than his back. I mean,
it's a question of fact, I think.
I don't think it's a question of fact. When you look at the video, it's clear that her knee is on his buttock. And it's also clear that she is there to hold that leg still for the purpose of the leg irons being placed on. As soon as the leg iron is on, she leaves. She sees this kick. She sees Mr. Krueger kick Deputy Standiford. She goes to immobilize that leg so it can be leg iron to prevent that very action. As soon as the leg iron's on, she leaves and goes back to her car.
She's also still there. She's also still there. I think she's there at the end when he's subdued for a good 90 seconds. He's not moving. She's still there. The other officer's still there. That's the failure to intervene claim, right?
Yeah. Well,
if she doesn't sit on his back, even if she's just over here, she's sitting there as he's motionless.
The record is that she went back to her car and doesn't come back.
I'm not before that. The failure to intervene while he's motionless, she's sitting on him, the other officer's sitting on him. I'm not talking right now about excessive force itself. I'm talking about the failure to intervene.
Well, we could talk about the failure to intervene.
He's motionless and being subdued in that way.
She's holding down his leg for the leg irons. As soon as
assume she's not on his back. Assume she's watching the other officer who's sitting on him and he's subdued. That's what she's doing.
Well, we could talk about the failure to intervene claim. The failure to intervene claim was not properly pled in this case at all. In fact, if you look at the specific paragraphs of plaintiff's fourth amended complaint, they amended their complaint four times and never clarified this issue at all. In the fourth amended complaint, if you look at paragraphs 30 and 31, which they cite to, those claims are largely against the EMS provider standing by.
But they say all state officers and failed to lend assistance. I mean, we have case law that is pretty forgiving on failure to intervene claims.
Well, that's a giant catch-all. I guess a plaintiff could put that in any claim. Well, we claim all claims against all defendants in all manner.
Well, that's not exactly what they said. It's in the same paragraph. And it talks about all state actors who failed to assist him in his cries for help, or it's a failure to intervene claim.
Well, the failure to intervene claim, again, we don't believe it was properly.
Well, let's say we believe it is. What's your response then to Judge Moritz's?
Well, my response to Judge Moritz is that we still believe that she would have qualified immunity for that claim, given her minimum contact with the defendant, and that she didn't actually see that. I don't think that there is direct evidence.
She didn't see what?
She didn't see that there was a
she didn't
substantial,
see that he was subdued?
Significant weight.
She couldn't see that he was subdued at this point?
Well.
And another officer was sitting on his back?
If we go to the Weigel case.
Well, she testified in her deposition she was aware other officers were placing weight on his back.
But that still has to be significant. In fact,
well, it was significant enough to break his ribs. And we have case law that talks about that you look at the combined weight of all of the officers. I think Lieutenant Crockett alone, you're 200 pounds on 156-pound defendant.
The only evidence that Crockett would have been subjected to of anyone being on Mr. Krueger's back was a foot on his shoulder at that time. When she was down there on his buttock and his upper thigh, there's no one else on his back other than McFarlane, I think, who had his foot on his shoulder. And so the significant weight on his back, I mean, if we look at the Weigel case, I don't believe that case is sufficiently particularized to the facts of this case with regard to Crockett as to place the constitutional question beyond debate. She, in Weigel, it says that the law was clearly established that applying pressure to Mr. Weigel's upper back once he was handcuffed and his legs restrained was unconstitutional. When she was there, his legs weren't restrained. In fact, she had just seen him kick Deputy Standiford, and that's why she was restraining his leg, and she leaves the area as soon as the leg irons are on. But back to the instance of the whether or not the failure to intervene claim was properly pled, even the district court says that it's abundantly unclear And this court said in the Zakari versus Gates case, 561 Fed 3rd, 1076 at page 1086, when a claim has not been pled, the appropriate response by the district court is not to determine whether such a claim can be read into the complaint, but rather to determine whether amendment should be allowed at that stage of the case. And so that's what the court should have done. There's been argument by the appellee's counsel that Ms. Crockett wasn't prejudiced. She absolutely was prejudiced because we didn't argue a failure to intervene claim in our motion for summary judgment. We tried to bring it up in our reply to plaintiff's response where we're limited in the number of pages that we can write and we have to address everything else. In fact, we even filed a motion to reconsider and the court said that it was improper because we were re-arguing things that we could have argued. Well, we didn't know to argue those things because it wasn't sufficiently pled on the failure to intervene. We believe the failure to intervene should not even be looked at by this court with regard to Lieutenant Crockett because it wasn't properly raised against her even after the fourth amended complaint. And it's also important for this court, I hope, to recognize with regard to Lieutenant Crockett and Deputy Lott, the courts said when they were reviewing the Graham factors, it said the Graham factors weigh in her favor. As to the first, Lieutenant Crockett received Deputy Orr's radio request stating, one fighting. Mr. Krueger's resistance of officers in the middle of the highway posed an immediate threat to the safety of himself, the deputies and the officers, as well as others on the highway. As to the third factor, Mr. Krueger was actually resisting arrest. We know when she showed up at the scene and first had contact with Mr. Krueger, the district court found that he was still resisting at that time. In fact, Lieutenant Crocker saw him kick Deputy Standiford, which led her to restrain that leg in order to give enough time for the officers to put leg irons. We believe that those cases that were cited with regard to the established constitutional law on the question of qualified immunity against her for restraining the leg, which she just saw kick the deputy, don't establish that what she did was improper. We believe that the failure to intervene claim should be disregarded as it was not properly pled, and that when you talk about the Weigel and even Cruz cases, the Cruz case says it's clearly established that putting substantial or significant pressure on a suspect's back, which she didn't do, when that suspect is in a face down position after being subdued and or incapacitated constitutes excessive force. He clearly wasn't incapacitated or subdued. He had just kicked Deputy Standiford. She's there for 45 to 60 seconds and immediately leaves the scene. My time is up. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Mr. Kemet, you're not splitting time with anyone, is that right?
Good morning, and may it please the court. Chris Kemet on behalf of plaintiffs, including Jeffrey Krueger's mother, Pamela, who's with us in court today. We are here because the defendants escalated a traffic stop that never should have happened into a fatal encounter. And they did so by using serious and ultimately deadly levels of force that were wholly disproportionate to the dangers that they faced. This encounter began because Orr wanted to get his partner, Phillips, some practice with DUI enforcement, and so he directed him to stop Mr.
The stuff that happened before the traffic stop isn't really before us, is it?
I think it's only before you in the sense that when we're looking at the totality of the circumstances, the fact that they pulled him over for no reason, the fact that they pulled their guns on him and escalated that situation, I think that that's all relevant to what's before you. But It's certainly clear that...
It's not part of what the district court's findings, is it?
I think inherently in a Fourth Amendment case, you've got all the totality of the circumstances. So I think that it is relevant, but I also don't think that it's crucial to where we are today.
Okay.
So turning forward, I think that a helpful place to start is with Cruz, both because it presents a straightforward jurisdictional argument. It presents a straightforward issue of clearly established law, and Cruz is the hogtie case. And it both directly and indirectly requires affirmance of the judgments against all of the individual defendants. So to begin with the jurisdictional issue, Cruz has a very clear holding. It says, we hold that officers may not apply the hogtie technique when an individual's diminished capacity is apparent. The district court issued an equally clear ruling on this particular point, saying plaintiffs have presented sufficient disputed evidence to meet their burden to show that officers used a hogtie restraint on Mr. Krueger.
Didn't the district court say, are you talking about this district court or the one in Cruz?
This district court.
I thought he said hobble tie.
So
there is a difference.
There is a difference. So he says hog tie restraint. So this is in the clear.
You mean the district court in our case?
In our case.
Says
here, this is a direct quote from the district court in our case. Plaintiffs have presented sufficient disputed evidence to meet their burden to show that officers used a hog tie restraint on Mr. Krueger when his diminished capacity was apparent. That's a direct quote from the decision involving McFarland and Craig. So he's found a genuine dispute of material fact about hogtie. He found a genuine dispute of material fact about diminished capacity. And McFarland and Craig they don't take issue with the clearly established law there. All they take issue with are those two findings that there are these genuine disputes of material fact. And that's something that this court has no jurisdiction to consider. So that tosses out McFarland and Craig's hogtie arguments. This court should also affirm because the district court...
The hobble or hogtie was not placed on him until the very end. I mean, he was likely already dead by the time they put that on him. I mean, is that really where we focus here in terms of... We're supposed to look at the moment when the force was applied. And are you suggesting that we should be focused on when they put the tie on between the leg restraints and the hand restraints?
Oh, to be clear, we think that there are a number of different bases for the for using excessive force in this case. Slamming his head, using the taser repeatedly, the Weigel claim with respect to putting weight on his back...
And Weigel, there's no argument of a hog or a hobble tie or anything, right?
No, there's not. I mean, so this case also fits comfortably under Weigel. It's just, we started with Cruz because much like the situation in Cruz, they attached a hog tie and the man dies almost immediately after the hog tie is applied. So I think that those two are quite similar. But this court also...
Let's talk about the Weigel issue.
Yes, Your Honor.
Is there clearly established law prohibiting that sort of pressure on the back of a suspect who's still resisting?
There is clearly established law.
I'm sorry, go ahead.
So I think that Weigel's point doesn't turn on whether or not there is continued resistance.
Oh,
it has
don't?
To turn.
I think it turns on whether he's
subdued or restrained.
Well, that's what, yeah. If you're still resisted, you're not subdued and restrained.
So
what's the difference?
I think that this court's recent decision in Lynch, which isn't clearly established law, but it finds applying Weigel that the facts that the court addressed in Lynch were clearly established. That's a case where the individual, unlike here, did continue to resist after an ankle restraint was put on him. Uh-huh. So he was face down.
So someone is still resisting.
But he was restrained.
So to the extent that Mr. Krueger was resisting, the use of that force on his back, it's not clearly established as being improper. maybe it's improper, but it's not clearly established law. I'm going to focus on that. We'll take this step by step.
Sure. I think that so long as he is restrained, even if he is moving his feet, and moving his feet is probably because he is being suffocated to death, not because he's resisting. So if he is moving his feet, if the officers have control over the situation, then I think he is still restrained and Weigel still applies with full force.
And what case clearly establishes that? That even if he's resisting, if he's restrained, you can't use that force. Do we have a case saying that?
That is what happened in Lynch, and Lynch said that Weigel provided clearly established law, and that was a jury question.
Lynch is not precedential, right?
It is not precedential, so it's only persuasive. However,
it's nothing with regret to clearly established law. It's just not consistent.
Correct, but part of the finding in Lynch is that at a time prior to the incident here, Weigel was clearly established, and that Weigel applied to the facts in Lynch. So that's the point I'm trying to...
And in Lynch, qualified immunity was denied.
Correct.
And the suspect was still resisting or moving his feet, which is...
Yes, he was still... So the suspect in Lynch was still resisting after an ankle chain was put on him. Mm-hmm. But the court found that he was still restrained at that point because they had chained his ankles.
And you're saying he was under control.
He was under control.
Even if he was still moving.
Yes. So this is just...
And at the end of the day, isn't that the issue? I mean, we're talking about use of force. If you've got him restrained, gotten back in the police car, if he's banging his head against the window, I guess he's resisting. But he's no danger to anybody except himself.
Yes,
right?
Your Honor. No, I think that's 100% true. So that's why in Perea, for instance, the court commented that Mr. Perea was subdued at a time when he wasn't handcuffed at all. He was just lying on his stomach with two police officers at his back. So if you look at this case, and I think that there at all of the times when the officers applied pressure to his back, that Mr. Krueger was restrained. But just to pick some of the easier times in the case.
Well, let me ask you this. How do the officers in the heat of the moment distinguish between someone who's kicking and flailing about because they can't breathe or to try and get away? I mean, we're asking them to make a pretty nuanced decision.
So I think that it's a little bit less complicated in this case. So Weigel, for instance, quoted a training that the officers there received that warned them not to mistake an officer, a subject moving their body because they are unable to breathe with resistance. So that's already in the case law. But the officers here were also trained that once you've got somebody and they're handcuffed and prone, what you have to do, even if they're resisting, is you get them on their side or you get them seated. So they were trained on that. And that's exactly what they did not do in this case.
That's clearly established law that not following that training and that police manual is a constitutional violation. That's what you need to do. It's not the manual is not going to clearly establish the law. And you may be very right that there's a violation. But what we're talking about is what does the law say? And I'm not sure the law is quite as clear as you're saying about what's clearly established. So if someone, you get on top of somebody, you have two officers on top of somebody, and he's not doing anything.
Yes.
So one gets up and says, we shouldn't restrain, and then the guy can fight off the person who's on top of him at the time. What's an officer supposed to do? That's why they handcuff, tie their feet, whatever. So that's why, even though the person is not resisting at that minute, the officers may still properly be concerned about whether what will happen if they stop using that force. And you agree with that?
Of course, Your Honor. But that's why I would posit that what the police should do in that instance is to follow their training, which is you could continue to restrain them but put them on their side. But I want to come back to the clearly established law.
Is that really legally relevant here?
I think that
they're
Weigel,
training on that because that we're not going to make the police manual clearly established Fourth Amendment.
Of course.
Yeah. Okay. Maybe it will be. But okay.
I think it speaks to the reasonableness, and I'm bringing this up only because Your Honor was asking what the officers should have done in this circumstance. And I was trying to explain that there was, that they should have just followed their training, that they weren't without recourse, that they, this wasn't something that was thrust upon them or unfair to put upon them because it's what their department puts upon them. So Weigel, of course, provides clearly established law. And it said in Weigel that applying pressure, and it didn't say significant pressure, to Mr. Weigel's back at a time when he was prone and handcuffed and his feet were restrained, that was a violation of clearly established law because of the risk of positional asphyxiation. So the district court found that that is exactly what we have here. Mr. Krueger was prone, he was restrained, he was handcuffed, and ultimately his ankles were shackled, and then he was even hogtied. And throughout that time, the officers remained on his back. McFarland remained on his back until the 4:05 mark in the Potts video when he's already stopped breathing. So there is no kind of question of clearly established law here because nobody disputes that putting weight on somebody's back when they meet these conditions is constitutional and that it's not clearly established. And the district court found, as a factual matter, which we're bound by today, that they did all of those things that Weigel says make out a clearly established violation of the law.
So you, let me just make sure I understand. You're saying that under Weigel, it's clearly established that once they had him in the leg shackles and the handcuffs, they could no longer put weight on his back. They had to either get off or turn him to his side. Is that, am I understanding correct?
I think Weigel just requires restraint. And so it's handy that in Weigel, there is an ankle restraint. And it says that he's restrained then. And here we have an ankle restraint plus pressure to the back. So that makes it really clear. But the point in Weigel, I don't think, was about an ankle restraint per se. It was about the fact that the individual was restrained. So here,
well,
if you
the ankle restraint was really important there because the problem with Mr. Weigel is he was running onto the highway.
Yes. I mean, that situation was so out of control that a civilian was about to hit him with a fence post right before that point. In our situation, in contrast, if you go to the 157 point of the Potts video, then what you're going to see is five different officers all applying their body weight to some part of the back of Mr. Weigel. There's no more real estate. If another officer wanted to kneel on him, it would not be possible.
And that was after he was, the ankle hobble, whatever you call it.
This is before. So
it's before the hobble, but his ankles are restrained. Right?
His both of his feet are held down at this point. So let me, I think it might be helpful if I quickly walk through different points in that Potts video.
Yeah, that's very important.
All right, so there is at some point he thrashes his leg a little bit because he is held down on his stomach. That's about the 154, 155 mark of the Potts video. At 157, starting at 157, McFarland is squarely on his back with two knees. Lott is standing on his right shoulder. Crockett is on either his lower back and thigh or his upper buttocks and thigh. Standiford is holding down one leg and also applying an ass to it to cause pain. And Potts is holding down his other leg. So we don't know how much all these people weigh, but we know that McFarland is 250 pounds. We know that Crockett is 200 pounds.
Let me ask you a question. While in that position, he kicked McFarland, is that right?
No.
That's not true.
Not true.
So you did he ever kick McFarland?
No. He kicked Standiford, I think, is what you're talking
about.
Oh,
sorry, yes.
So that was just before this. Okay. So at this point, he has five officers. He is as subdued can be at this point because he's got 1,000 pounds of officers holding down his body. He can't move at all. And we can see the body cam video throughout this
period. But he's subdued because those officers are on him. If they all got up, did he have handcuffs on? Did he have
leg? He was handcuffed. Yeah, he was handcuffed at that time. So he is handcuffed prior to the beginning of the Potts video. Later in the Phillips body cam video, he's handcuffed. And there's a period in that video where Phillips is on his back when he is restrained and on his stomach. And that's also a potential basis for affirmance. But at this particular point in time, so he has five police officers on him. And then between 217 and 237 in the video, the EMT comes up to speak to him. And at this point, he's no longer capable of speech, and all he does is grunt and moan, which if you put together testimony from the two plaintiff's experts, is a sign of agonal respiration. It's a sign that he is about to die. So plaintiff's medical expert says, at this point, and everybody can hear this, Lott, who's standing next to him, McFarland says he can hear it. One of the other defendants, Blair, who's standing nearby, says he can hear this. He is about to die. He is not moving. You can see the video from 157 through 405. There, he doesn't flinch. He doesn't move a finger. He doesn't move a leg. It doesn't matter who's on him. He is subdued. He is potentially not conscious for all of this time. So by 237, at the very latest, he is about to die. You can hear the officers continuing to remain on him after that. You can hear Crockett laughing at the three-minute mark, because this is not a situation that is a split-second dangerous situation for the police. They're telling jokes. By the 311 mark, his feet are shackled by the ankles, and McFarland continues to remain on his back after that point. At about 354, the hogtie restraint is applied to his back, or, you know, binds his wrist to his ankles. And then at 405, McFarland finally gets off his back, because at that point they've realized that he has stopped breathing. So throughout the entirety of that time, he was subdued, pressure was applied to his back, and that was deadly force. There was no cause to use deadly force. There certainly wasn't a situation in which there was probable cause to believe that Mr. Krueger raised the specter of death or serious bodily injury to any of these officers, as would be necessary to warrant the use of excessive force. So I think that this is an open and shut kind of use of excessive force under Weigel, and nobody disputes that Weigel is clearly established law, which is what we need here after qualified immunity.
Are you done with that?
With that
train?
Yes. Yep.
Let me talk to you about failure to intervene.
That's just where I was going to go. That's great.
You know, the complaint is not very well pled on that claim as against the officers. It's pretty clear you want to bring it against the EMT, I think two EMTs, but it is a stretch. The district court gave it to you, but why should we find it was adequately pled?
To be clear, Your Honor, that could have been more clearly pled, but this court's standard, as stated in Fogarty versus Gallegos, where they don't even say failure to intervene, is really very low. So they say all law enforcement officials who fail to intervene are on the hook. We have law enforcement officials. There's the bit about Mr. Krueger calling out for help. Nobody provides him help. And it also incorporates the Potts body cam video, which shows all of the officers failing to intervene. But I want to pivot quickly, because I think that there's a better point, which is that this court's case law is clear that you can still consider these sorts of theories of liability so long as there isn't prejudice. And this was actually litigated before the district court, like a few years ago, putting everybody on notice that failure to intervene was part of this case. So it's a little bit rich that...
When was this litigated?
You're saying 2022.
Before this court or the district court?
District court.
In this case?
In this case.
Well, we just heard from counsel for Ms. Crockett, who said that when they filed the brief, they didn't even know there was a failure to intervene issue in the case, so they didn't argue it, and then they were left with just their reply with fewer pages. You know, that sounds like that might be some prejudice.
Sure, Your Honor, but I think it's a little curious that Crockett has made that point, because Crockett moved to dismiss the third amended complaint, which is identical with the exception of the addition of body cam videos to the fourth amended complaint. And so Crockett moved to dismiss the third amended complaint. And plaintiffs opposed that in part by saying that Crockett was responsible for failing to intervene. So if you look at document number 116 on the docket, pages 9 and 10, plaintiffs are arguing that Crockett should stay in the case because of failure to intervene. And the district court then decides this motion to dismiss in an order in March of 2022, and it's document number 153, and you can look at pages 4 to 6 and note 4. And in that decision, the district court makes clear that the failure to intervene claim was not raised as clearly as it could be, but he thinks that Crockett had notice of it, and he says that it is part of that case. And so this is at the very outset of discovery. So the defendants all knew as of March 31st, 2022, that failure to intervene was part of this case, and they went through all of discovery and had all of the opportunities to push back on that, particularly Crockett, who this was said in response to Crockett's motion. And you can see, so there's 15 months between that decision and when the defendants all filed for summary judgment. And you can tell that the defendants took this to heart, most of them, because if you look at the declarations that they filed with their summary judgment papers, most of them end with a series of paragraphs that are solely there to disclaim liability for failure to intervene, which would be a very curious thing to do if failure to intervene was not part of the case. So there's no prejudice to any of these folks for including failure to intervene. It's also the same nucleus of facts. And the district court also was empowered to treat the summary judgment opposition from plaintiffs as a motion to amend under Rule 15. So I think failure to intervene should be in the case. And the district court has already made factual findings that every single one of the defendants saw the constitutional violations take place, had the opportunity to intervene, and didn't do so. That is a factual finding. It's in both of the district court's orders. And he says that plaintiffs have presented sufficient disputes of material fact. So that's something that this court doesn't have jurisdiction to reconsider. So it's in the case. There are factual findings applying it to every defendant. And so finding that there is this Weigel violation not only sweeps in the individuals who did the Weigel violation themselves, it brings in all of the other defendants on a failure to intervene theory.
Let me ask you, there's the fact that a constitutional violation is going on and someone in an officer sees it doesn't necessarily mean that the officer knows it's a constitutional violation. For example, let's take hog tying, and that's improper, according to our precedents, if it's someone who is mentally disabled at the time. What if an officer came up, saw someone being hogtied, but had no knowledge of the information that led the officers hogtying the suspect to know that the suspect was mentally disabled from drugs or something like that? Would the officer who arrived at that point still be clearly in violation of a constitutional right at that point?
You know,
don't you have to make those distinctions and be
the way that this court has defined failure to intervene liability is just that there is a constitutional violation and it's seen by the other defendant and they had an opportunity to intervene and they didn't. So it doesn't make allowances for that. So I think under this court's...
Have we explicitly said that we don't make allowances for that, or it just hasn't come up?
I would say it just hasn't come up.
Because I mentioned the hog tying as one example, but another might be the force used on someone's back is okay. At least it's not clearly established as wrong if the person is struggling. And it may not be obvious to an officer several feet away whether the person is struggling or not, or what had happened just before. Would that make a difference in whether the officer is liable for failure to intervene?
Respectfully, Your Honor, I don't think that's before this court because that would be a jury question. And also because on the facts that we have them in this case, there's a very prolonged period of time where Mr. Krueger is just fully, thoroughly subdued, and the officers remain on his back. It's not a fast-moving situation. They don't need to make split-second kind of judgments in order to navigate a tricky situation. There's just a situation where Mr. Krueger is near death. There's a whole lot of police officers on him. They're applying pressure to his back, and it is, at the very minimum, a jury question. as to whether all of these folks committed failure to intervene, which the district court found that they did. All right, so we've moved through Cruz, Weigel, and failure to intervene. I do want to say that this court should also affirm on the two other bases that we briefed, one of which the district court directly reached, and one of which the district court kind of sort of reached, which is the tasing. So first, with respect to the head slam, we think this court should affirm the judgment of the district court because we're talking about a situation in which Mr. Krueger was pulled over for some minor traffic misdemeanors. He's then yanked out of the car by his hair, and he's slammed to the ground with truly an unusual level of force, sufficient to open a very nasty gash in his head and to break a significant number of his ribs.
Is there video of that part of the action?
There isn't. And the reason there isn't video of that is because Phillips either didn't turn on his body-worn camera or didn't turn over the footage from the beginning of the incident. And I only raise the second possibility because in every case that I've ever seen, body-worn cameras begin with 30 seconds of silence because they back record the video part of it after you hit. It's always capturing the previous 30 seconds. And then the sound comes in 30 seconds in. And we don't see that here, but we do see it with Potts. But regardless, well, Phillips didn't turn on.
Okay, so the issue with respect to the slamming the head against the pavement is we don't know if that happened, but the district court thought there was sufficient evidence for a jury to believe that that happened and it wasn't justified. Am I correct about that?
Yes, Your Honor. But I think that
we have testimony from one of the officers that they yanked him out of that car by the hair,
yes.
Right?
And also that they brought him to the ground.
But they certainly don't say they slammed his head twice on the asphalt.
They do not. However, the plaintiff's medical expert says that the way that you would get the kind of size of the head gash that he got, and one of the couple ways that he could get all these broken ribs were by being slammed to the ground. And if you look at the spot where the blood is all over the street, it's right next to the car. It's not where he ends up a little bit later on with the officers on top of him. So it's very consistent. It's strong circumstantial evidence that what happened there is that the officers, after they took him out of the car, just slammed his body down into the ground at a point where Mr. Krueger was outnumbered, where they could see his hands. They could see that he didn't have any weapons.
Why don't you go to the taser?
All right, let's go to the taser. All right, so the taser, the district court doesn't say really much of anything about the taser, except that there are disputes of material fact about how many times Mr. Krueger got tased. But he doesn't otherwise, and he suggests that that's the basis of a constitutional violation. The district court doesn't fully spell it out, and he doesn't revisit it later on when he's doing his clearly established law violation. But a jury could reasonably find that this is basically what happened. Mr. Krueger has just been slammed into the ground. He has broken a number of ribs. He's bleeding out of his head. Perhaps he is concussed, or who weighs 290 pounds, has climbed onto the back of Mr. Krueger, who weighs 156 pounds. And at that point in time, and or says that he's got two knees pinning him down, and they demand that Mr. Krueger produce his right arm, which is pinned under his body, which a jury could reasonably find he could not produce. And without giving him any warning, they or proceeds to tase him. And he tases him in drive stun mode, which is just intended to cause extreme pain, which also, as plaintiff's experts testify, make it impossible for him to comply with commands. So,
was there some confusion on the expert of whether what was recorded in terms of the voltage of the taser was actually applied to Mr. Krueger?
So here's what the facts show. The expert made a mistake the first time that he testified, and he said there were 7 applications shown in the taser register when in fact there were 10, and he corrected himself later on. But I don't think that this raises a significant issue because Orr admits...
Well, that's not what I'm asking.
Oh, I'm
asking about the voltage. I thought that counsel for the defendant said that plaintiff's own expert indicated that he was testifying from the report of the taser use, but couldn't say whether, even though the taser was being engaged, whether it was actually making contact with Mr. Krueger.
Yes. All the expert is saying is the report itself just tells you how many times the taser is used.
Right.
It doesn't tell you how it's used.
Okay.
But we have a lot of other evidence. We have the video. But even before the video, Orr just admits that he tased him three times. So there's three tasings from Orr, which actually matches exactly what the taser register shows. So then there's seven from Phillips. We can see at least four on the video itself. There are three in relatively quick succession when Orr is holding Mr. Krueger down and Phillips tases him three times in a row, the last time in the groin. And then there is a little bit of time during that tasing when he continues to depress the taser when it's not on his body. But that taser application began on his body. There's a fourth time later on that you can tell that the taser is being used on his body. So there are three missing taser applications. And there's no reason to think that those didn't. So there's seven that we know for sure involve his body. There are no other times where the taser goes off on the video where you can, because you can hear the sound, where it's not connected to his body. So the video shows no taser usage not connected to his body that didn't at least begin in his body. So there are three missing ones with Phillips, and I think a jury could reasonably find he tased him three times right before the body cam video starts. And this is corroborated by the fact that when the body cam video starts, Mr. Krueger is defending himself from Phillips waving a taser at him. So he's clearly, I think, just tased him since we have those three missing times. But regardless...
That's a fact question is what you're saying.
It's a fact question. Whether it's seven...
evidence... I want to be sure I'm understanding what you're saying. Because I thought what counsel for defense was saying was that the expert said there was no evidence of contacts. But what she was saying was the report itself doesn't... That's what you're
yes.
representing,
yes.
she was saying. The report itself doesn't verify the contacts.
Yes.
But we can look at the video and see that there were at least seven contacts, and that each time there was a taser used, there was contact in the video.
Yes.
Is that correct?
Well, or there's three that Orr did that are off video, but Orr just says that he tased him.
Three that you...
Three by Orr off video.
Question because...
Well, Orr admits that he tased him three
oh,
times
he does.
Off video.
Okay. Okay.
And you can see Phillips do it four times on video. So there's just this question of three missing ones with Phillips, where I think a jury could reasonably conclude that he tased him three additional times. But I don't think that like a whole lot turns on this. They tased him seven times. They tased him 10 times. Either way, they've already smashed his body. The man is already en route to dying. And then they just proceed to tase him over and over and over again because he can't produce his hands. Because a 290-pound man is lying on top of his back. Like, he's not warned. This is totally disproportionate to the situation. It's not tailored towards any sort of reasonable police end. And I think that this court's case law makes clear that that violates clearly established law. So we've got the tasing, we've got the head slam, we've got the pressure on the back, we've got the hog tie, and we've got all of the defendants seeing all of these things and failing to intervene. So there are layer after layer of reasons to affirm the judgment of the district court, and we would urge this court to do so.
Thank you, counsel.
Thank you.
I think the appellants had already exhausted all their time. Okay. Thank you, counsel. Case is submitted and the counsel are excused.